Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. I spotted a video the other day about there being DNA evidence that proves that Jack the Ripper was a Jew, and I thought I would just quickly create a little video where I discuss this. Because a couple of years ago, I made a video, quite a detailed video, complete with a documentary, where I showed that the British police were absolutely convinced that Jack the Ripper was the Jewish suspect in that case. That of all the suspects that they had, that it was the Jew that was unquestionably the killer, the serial killer. And so when I saw this video about some whites now having DNA evidence, I thought I would do a quick update on this matter and point people to the original video that I did. But I also quickly added a bunch of other videos, not all of the videos, but a bunch of other videos that relate to either Jews trying to kill whites, which includes a discussion with Tom Metzger, who said that the Jews had a contract out to kill him, but also other instances. And then I included a couple of links to rare occasions where whites have killed Jews. There's another quite special video that I did, and it's actually a two-part video about the guy who killed a Jew named Allard Lowenstein. Lowenstein was actually a very important liberal Jew in America, and Lowenstein got up to a lot of nonsense. He even came to Africa to create problems for the whites here. Allard Lowenstein was even elected to Congress. He was a Democratic congressman representing New York's 5th Congressional District. Lowenstein is a very important Jew. He was very active in lots and lots of things, and he was messing with people's minds. He was deeply into politics. And Lowenstein is a very strange and interesting character. And I discovered the information about Lowenstein and dug into Lowenstein because of stuff that he did relating to Southern Africa. But Lowenstein was murdered, and Lowenstein was murdered by a white guy who knew him very well and even had been his supporter. So the Allard Lowenstein video is also below, and you can browse the rest of the links below the video. But the main video I want to draw your attention to is that I did a video about Jack the Jewish Ripper. Jack the Ripper in England. And I added into it another little known story about a girl in South Africa. A white Afrikaans girl in South Africa. And her name was Bubbles Schroeder. She was an Afrikaans girl. She lived here in Johannesburg, where I live. And when she was murdered, all the prime suspects were Jews. Jews were the last guys who saw her. And it appears to me that Jews were responsible for her murder and got away with her murder. So in that video, I also discuss Mary Fagan a bit, but also Bubbles Schroeder. And it's in that Jack the Jewish Ripper video. And there are still other crimes committed by Jews that are worth telling, but they're not that important. However, Jack the Ripper was a big topic in Britain, and the Jack the Ripper files were closed for a long time. I see on the internet they say that the files were opened in 1975. I was sure that it was a later date than that, because I recall that the Jack the Ripper files were closed for 100 years. But what is astounding is that private people and people related to the murder victims have continued to dig and to try to find ways of solving this crime. Now, in the previous video that I did, where there's a whole documentary, the bottom line in the documentary was that of the different suspects that they had, the police were so confident that the actual criminal was the Jewish suspect, a guy called Kosminski. And if you look on the screen in front of you, you'll see Kosminski on the left. That is a drawing of the Polish barber Kosminski. And what the police did was they actually took him and put him into an insane asylum. And he was in the insane asylum until he died round about 1919. And the police were so certain that they got their man that the moment they put him into the insane asylum, they immediately stood down all the cops who had been on the beat looking for Jack the Ripper and protecting the people. They immediately stood down all the police, and there was never again another Jack the Ripper murder. So the police themselves knew unquestionably that Jack the Ripper was the Polish Jew. But of course, there are many questions as to why didn't this go to trial? Why wasn't it published? Or were Jews busy trying to silence this whole story so that the cops then had to solve the problem, but nobody could be told? And to the public, it remains a mystery for a century and more. So have a look at the video that I did about Jack the Jewish Ripper. But I thought I would show you a quick little video that came out the other day about DNA tests relating to Jack the Ripper, where they can now prove that this is Jack the Ripper. And I also want to show you another article that appeared in the Daily Mail in the UK back in 2019, where they had another way in which someone also discovered other evidence that pointed to exactly the same guy. So there are just a couple of things that I want to tell you in this video, some additional stuff all relating to Jack the Ripper, and also how it was that people began to wonder if the serial killer was a Jew. Plus, I want to show you some crime scene photos from back then. This man was a horrific killer. And then I also want to touch on Lewis Carroll. Lewis Carroll is best known for writing Alice in Wonderland. But Lewis Carroll is a very, very, very clever guy. And Lewis Carroll has been falsely accused of not only being Jack the Ripper, but of being a Satanist and all kinds of other weird stuff. So on the screen in front of you on the right is Lewis Carroll, a white genius, an awesome guy whose reputation has been dragged through the mud. And I want to explain to you why. Here's the video, and this is a recent news story, and you will see the efforts that have been made in Britain to finally prove using DNA that this is Aaron Kosminski. Aaron Kosminski is the Polish Jew who was Jack the Ripper. So just watch this because I have some comments afterwards.
But first, there are thousands of unsolved murders in London, some dating back not just decades, but hundreds of years. The most famous of those, the Jack the Ripper murders, a killing spree which left at least five women dead in the East End in 1888. Now, 137 years on from the killings, the descendants of his victims are hopeful that the truth can finally be revealed. It all comes down to a shawl found beside one of the women killed. Here's Carolyn Sim.
The case of Jack the Ripper has fascinated audiences for decades. A man who murdered at least five women, but whose real identity remains a mystery. But behind the intrigue about him and the streets of Whitechapel where he targeted his victims are families who still want justice.
That name, Jack the Ripper, to me is just a character. It doesn't make him out to be a real person.
From Mitre Square, where her great-great-great-grandmother's body was found, Karen Miller told me she wants a fresh inquest into the murders after DNA evidence emerged which she believes identifies the killer. Her ancestor, Catherine Eddowes, had been forced into prostitution in 1888 because she was destitute.
I can't imagine what it was like walking those streets at 12:45 in the morning. It must have been really scary. The evidence we've got now that's been pulled together, I just think, you know, if that evidence was around then, he would have been convicted.
As you can see, the blood stains.
The evidence was found on a blood-stained shawl next to Catherine's body. Russell Edwards bought the shawl at auction in 2007 and paid for it to be analysed. DNA matched that of Catherine's descendants and of a Polish barber, Aaron Kosminski, who was a suspect at the time.
What are your feelings about this man?
A sadistic killer that should really have been put away a long time before he was.
So what does it mean to you for him to be officially and formally named?
Closure for the families, which is really important. But really the end of, for me, 25 years of a very long story.
At the inquest in 1888, the coroner returned a verdict of willful murder. If a fresh inquest goes ahead, it would be the only way of confirming what happened.
Will this legal proceeding finally, once and for all, name Jack the Ripper?
Well, it essentially will, but we cannot say, yes, there will be a verdict that says this man was the killer, because the coroner cannot do that. But the way the judgment can be created would leave little room for doubt. And that's as good as you can get now. Obviously, you cannot try the man himself. He's been dead for 120 years. But there would be an ability to close off a lot of the chatter about individuals.
The families know Jack the Ripper will remain a famous name in history, but by revealing his real identity, they hope his victims won't be forgotten. Carolyn Sim, ITV News, Whitechapel.
So there you can see that there is a white Englishman who has spent 25 years doing his own thing in search of the truth to try and find some kind of proof that will solve this case. And remember that I have said before that white people, that we whites have got truth as our highest value. That the one thing that our race keeps doing is we try to get to the truth, because the truth is the most important thing of all. And here you can see an Englishman who's used his own money and time, and he has tried to solve this problem, and he has. He's managed to get this shawl from the murder, he bought it, and he's clearly had all the right DNA tests done, including the DNA of the murderer. So exactly how he got Kosminski's DNA, I don't know, but he's had the tests done. Now they want to put this through a legal proceeding. But notice that they will probably be able to get this almost 100% proven, yet they might have to leave certain loopholes open, so to speak. That is always the thing that concerns me. With lots of these Jewish things, it's as if you are not allowed to get to a definitive answer and put it out in the mass media for the whole world to see. That when it comes to something like this, that maybe there is some kind of a bit of interference or something. I don't know, but I detest this. And when I look back on paedophiles, not just Epstein, but Lord Jenner in England, all these paedophiles, notice how no real evidence ever came to the fore. Nothing could really come out to really show you what scumbags they were. And that to me is always as if we get to the edge of the truth. We get to 99%, but they just won't go and plaster it on the front page of all the media in the world to say, yes, we've found the solution to Jack the Ripper or Lord Jenner or Epstein, and this is the solution, and here it is for the whole freaking world to see. It's always as if they pull back a little bit, just like those cops did back then. And to me, that is suspicious. Lord Jenner, Epstein, and other Jews, there are many examples where they come as close as damn it to catching the guy. And then there's a whole bunch of weird stuff. In the case of Jana, he dies. Epstein also dies. And in neither case does it actually go to court. And do you actually see the evidence? I hate that. Anyhow, let me read a couple of things to you about Jack the Ripper from the Wikipedia page about Jack the Ripper, because I want to point out a few things to you. In the section under background, it says the following. In the mid-19th century, England experienced an influx of Irish immigrants who swelled the populations of the major cities, including the East End of London. Now listen to this. From 1882, Jewish refugees fleeing pogroms in the Russian Empire and other areas of Eastern Europe emigrated into the same area. The parish of Whitechapel in the East End became increasingly overcrowded, with the population increasing to approximately 80,000 inhabitants by 1888. So you've got all these Jews fleeing from justice elsewhere. These Jews are fleeing from justice by the Russians and justice by the Eastern Europeans, and the British are taking them in. And lots of these Jews are in the East End of London. So now I want to jump down to another part of the Wikipedia page, because it says the following. It talks about the media of the time, and it says the following. However, many of the articles were sensationalistic and speculative, and false information was regularly printed as fact. Now listen to this. In addition, several articles speculating as to the identity of the Ripper alluded to local xenophobic rumors that the perpetrator was either Jewish or foreign. So it appears that the local English began to wonder about this weird set of hideous crimes. And perhaps they were talking among themselves and saying, you know, we got all these foreigners now who've moved into this area. We never had this problem before. And we got all these Jews and foreigners. Maybe the killer is one of them. So just to show you that the locals must have been wondering, with all these new people pouring into that particular area, they are now starting to ask the question, probably among themselves, would another Englishman do this kind of thing? That doesn't sound like a normal Englishman would do that. We don't have these crimes here. So just sit and think about that and the issue of race. I just want to mention another thing is that in the Jack the Ripper story, that lots of people wrote letters to the police, and there were letters that were fake and letters that were rubbish. But there's one letter that is very interesting, really interesting. There are three that are interesting, but when I look through this, the one that's the most interesting is a letter called From Hell. And it says, the From Hell letter was received by George Lusk, leader of the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee, on 16 October 1888. The handwriting style is unlike that of the Dear Boss letter and Saucy Jackie postcard. The letter came with a small box in which Lusk discovered half of a human kidney, preserved in spirits of wine, ethanol. Edo's left kidney, this is one of the murdered women, and it's the lady in the video, is related to this victim, Edo's. Now listen to this. Edo's left kidney had been removed by the killer. The writer claimed that he had fried and ate the missing kidney half. There is disagreement over the kidney. Some contend that it belonged to Edo's, while others argue that it was a macabre practical joke. The kidney was examined by Thomas Openshaw of the London Hospital, who determined that it was human and from the left side. But contrary to false news reports, he could not determine any other biological characteristics. Openshaw subsequently also received a letter signed Jack the Ripper. I thought I'd just mention this because it may show you what a demented bastard Jack the Ripper really was. Because it seems as if this particular letter may actually have been from the murderer. And how bizarre if he had actually fried and eaten the missing half of the kidney. This is very, very bizarre. And another thing, when they found this lady, Eddowes, when they found her body, listen to this. A section of Eddowes' bloodied apron was found at the entrance to a tenement in Goulston Street, Whitechapel, at 2:55 a.m. A chalk inscription upon the wall directly above this piece of apron read, "The Jews are the men that will not be blamed for nothing." And it's Jews spelled J-U-W-E-S. The Jews are the men that will not be blamed for nothing. So in Wikipedia it says, the message appeared to imply that a Jew or Jews in general were responsible for the series of murders, but it is unclear whether the graffiti was written by the murderer on dropping the section of apron or was merely incidental and nothing to do with the case. Such graffiti was commonplace in Whitechapel. The police commissioner, Sir Charles Warren, feared the graffiti might spark anti-Semitic riots and ordered the writing washed away before dawn. To me, it's almost like it's saying that Jews will not be blamed. That's what it seems to say to me. The Jews are the men that will not be blamed for nothing. So, a very bizarre thing, and maybe Jack the Ripper was a chatty kind of a bloke because of the letters, at least one or two letters, the letter to that guy with the kidney, and also a letter to the guy at the hospital who looked at the kidney, because clearly his name and all that had been published. Now, take a look at the image on the screen in front of you. This is also from Wikipedia, and it says, contemporaneous police drawing of the body of Catherine Eddowes, as discovered in Mitre Square. So if we read what the police discovered, and they drew this drawing, this will give you an idea that this is a hideous, hideous, demented murderer. It says, Eddowes' body was found in a corner of Mitre Square in the City of London, 3/4 of an hour after the discovery of the body of Elizabeth Stride. Her throat was severed from ear to ear, and her abdomen, if you look at that drawing, her abdomen ripped open by a long, deep, and jagged wound before her intestines had been placed over her right shoulder, with a section of the intestine being completely detached and placed between her body and left arm. So what a hideous bastard this is. He's not only slit her throat, now he's busy cutting open her stomach. Now listen to this. The left kidney and the major part of Eddowes' uterus had been removed and her face had been disfigured, with her nose severed, her cheek slashed, and cuts measuring 1/4 inch and 1/2 inch respectively, vertically incised through each of her eyelids, a triangular incision, the apex of which points towards Eddowes' eye, had been carved upon each of her cheeks, and a section of the auricle and lobe of her right ear was later recovered from her clothing. The police surgeon who conducted the post-mortem upon Eddowes' body stated his opinion that these mutilations would have taken at least 5 minutes to complete. So he not only kills the woman, but he now goes and does a whole bunch of other horrific, gruesome, hideous things. And it's this woman that he cuts half of her left liver out. The whole thing is extremely creepy, very, very disgusting and horrific. And it is this lady whose shawl has been connected with Aaron Kosminski, the Polish barber Jew. If you'll take a look at the screen in front of you, this is an actual official police photograph, also from the Wikipedia page, and it says, this is now another lady. This is Mary Jane Kelly, and it says, official police photograph of the body of Mary Jane Kelly as discovered in 13 Miller's Court, Spitalfields, 9 November 1888. What a horrific photo. And it's like the guy went to town on this woman. Look at that. It's like he disemboweled her. It's like he cut parts of her legs open. And it's also like he spent a lot of time cutting around her sexual organs. And look at her face. I mean, this is just beyond imagination, hey? This is as gruesome as the worst stuff that we see in Africa. It's out of this world. You know, a murderer like this should have been freaking tortured to death, man. I am just horrified by what I'm seeing. And one of the things that I want to tell you is that with all crimes, especially in modern times, where I am sure Jews, liberals, and blacks have all been trying to suppress crime scene photos, I want to tell you that it should be standard practice for police to publish crime scene photos, especially murder photos. I will tell you that if people had to see what happens to their loved ones, what happens to other people, people will get so angry that I'm telling you there will be no question about bringing back the death penalty and perhaps even going as far as the Romans, seeing to it that people are killed in a hideous way. I think the ancient Greeks had some torturous methods of killing people. I must tell you that this kind of stuff, this is no normal murder, hey? This is not just about killing. This is like weird, disgusting, hideous garbage. Absolute demented, horrific rubbish. This must have been a real shock to the local whites. And no wonder that the local whites were looking at this and then saying, maybe it's Jews or other foreigners who are in this area because we never had stuff like this before. You know, no normal Englishman would do shit like this. Here's the final photo. This one at least is not as horrific as the others, but this is the young lady, Frances Coles, was found with her throat cut under a railway arch in Whitechapel on 13 February 1891. So her throat was slit. And it does say on Wikipedia, PC, that is Police Constable Ernest Thompson, discovered a 31-year-old prostitute named Frances Coles lying beneath a railway arch at Swallow Gardens, Whitechapel. Her throat had been deeply cut, but her body was not mutilated, leading some to believe Thompson had disturbed her assailant. Coles was still alive, although she died before medical help could arrive. So she was actually still alive. Thank goodness. So mutilation, horrific, horrific, unbelievable mutilation, is definitely part of the Jack the Ripper story. No wonder they called him the Ripper, hey? Oh, it's horrific. And so that obviously shows people that this is a very particular murderer. He's got a very specific style, disgusting fiend. And to think that he was never hanged, he never went to court. He was quietly put away in an insane asylum where he simply died later. How horrible. How unfair. What a miscarriage of justice. I want to read to you some other things that I published on my website or that I found that relates to Jack the Ripper. Because this DNA analysis may have been done a while back. I'm not sure if this DNA analysis is different, but in October 2019, I published this story. And it's a story that I got from a website that no longer exists. The website is dailyarchives.org. That was a good website. And like many websites, it's no longer there. So listen to this. DNA analysis proves that serial killer Jack the Ripper was a Jew from Poland. While I was going through the article, even though the original website doesn't exist, to my amazement, I also had the link to the original Daily Mail UK story. So can you believe the original breakthrough occurred in 2014? This is 10 years ago. That same guy that you saw in that video, this was his original breakthrough back in 2014. So listen to this. The title says, World Exclusive, Jack the Ripper Unmasked, How Amateur Sleuth Used DNA Breakthrough to Identify Britain's Most Notorious Criminal 126 years after a string of terrible murders. And this is the DNA story. So let me read it. I'll read chunks of this. It says, a shawl found by the body of Catherine Eddowes, one of the Ripper's victims, has been analyzed and found to contain DNA from her blood as well as DNA from the killer. The landmark discovery was made after businessman Russell Edwards, that's the guy who was in the video, 48, bought the shawl at auction and enlisted the help of Dr. Jari Luhelainen, it's a very difficult surname to pronounce, a world-renowned expert in analyzing genetic evidence from historical crime scenes. Using cutting-edge techniques, Doctor was able to extract 126-year-old DNA from the material and compare it to DNA from descendants of Eddowes and the suspect, with both proving a perfect match. So they even managed to get descendants of the Jew to take part in the test. And so he seems to have found DNA from the killer on the shawl, as well as getting DNA out of the blood of Eddowes on the shawl. And it's all a perfect match. So there you've got it. That's the definitive story. But this was done 10 years ago. Now they're trying to get the courts to do some kind of legal process to now try and say definitively, for once and for all, this is the end of it. And it says, the revelation puts an end to the fevered speculation over the Ripper's identity, which has lasted since his murderous rampage in the most impoverished and dangerous streets of London. He ran around killing white prostitutes in the most horrific way. So just a bit more about this shawl. This shawl did not belong to Eddowes. She was a very poor woman. So what this businessman says, because it's quite a long story and I just want to grab the relevant parts, is he bought this thing at an auction in 2007 and he started looking at this thing. And this is actually a very expensive shawl. So he says, I reasoned that it made no sense for Eddowes to have owned the expensive shawl herself. This was a woman so poor, she had pawned her shoes the day before her murder. Isn't that disgusting, hey? A dirt poor woman, and then she gets killed in the most horrific way. It doesn't matter that she's a prostitute. That's minor. But could the Ripper have brought the shawl with him and left it as an obscure clue about when he was planning to strike next? It was just a hunch. And far from proof of anything, but it set me off on a journey. Before buying it, I spoke to Alan McCormack, the officer in charge of the Crime Museum, also known as the Black Museum. He told me the police had always believed they knew the identity of the Ripper. There you go. The cops knew who this guy was, just as I mentioned and discussed in the documentary. Chief Inspector Donald Swanson, the officer in charge of the investigation, had named him in his notes Aaron Kosminski, a Polish Jew who had fled to London with his family, escaping the Russian pogroms in the early 1880s. Maybe I should just pause there for a second and just talk a little bit about this. Here is a Jew who's fled from Russian pogroms, and pogroms are nothing more than justice, okay? The whites are sorting out the Jews who are shitbags and causing trouble elsewhere. I'm just wondering to myself, this is just me wondering, I wonder if this Jew, having fled from Russia, is now filled with hatred of white people. Could it be that this Jew is filled with a hatred of white people because the Russians are coming after them? And so now in his new home, which is also among white people, maybe this is part of revenge. You know, one should really sit and think real long and hard about these people. And the whites who take these human trash in should really be sitting and thinking carefully. Like when America allowed Jews in, etc. Should you really allow these people into your country? You're dealing with people who are problems for other white people, and maybe by letting them into your country, they're going to become a problem for you. They bring with them maybe their hatreds and their bad behavior. So anyway, let's continue. Kosminski has always been one of the three most credible suspects. He is often described as having been a hairdresser in Whitechapel. The occupation written on his admission papers to the workhouse in 1890. What is certain is that he was seriously mentally ill, probably a paranoid schizophrenic who suffered auditory hallucinations and described as a misogynist prone to self-abuse, a euphemism for masturbation. McCormack said police did not have enough evidence to convict Kosminski, despite identification by a witness, but kept him under 24-hour surveillance until he was committed to mental asylums for the rest of his life. I became convinced Kosminski was our man, and I was excited at the prospect of proving it. I felt sure that modern science would be able to produce real evidence from the stains on the shawl. After a few false starts, I found a scientist I hoped could help. The tests began in 2011 when Jari, that's the scientist, used special photographic analysis to establish what the stains were. Using an infrared camera, he was able to tell me the dark stains were not just blood, but consistent with arterial blood spatter caused by slashing, exactly the grim death Catherine Eddowes had met. But the next revelation was the most heart-stopping. Under UV photography, a set of fluorescent stains showed up, which Jari said had the characteristics of semen. I'd never expected to find evidence of the Ripper himself. This was so thrilling, although Jari cautioned me that more testing was required before any conclusions could be drawn. He also found evidence of spilt body parts during the frenzied attack. One of Eddowes' kidneys, we've discussed the kidneys, was removed by the murderer. And later in his research, Jari managed to identify the presence of what he believed to be a kidney cell. It was impossible to extract DNA from the stains on the shawl using the method employed in current cases in which swabs are taken. The samples were just too old. Instead, he used a method called vacuuming using a pipette filled with a special buffering liquid that removed the genetic material in the cloth without damaging it. As a non-scientist, I found myself in a new world, as Jari warned that it would also be impossible to use genomic DNA, which is used in fresh cases and contains a human's entire genetic data, because over time it would have become fragmented. But he explained it would be possible to use mitochondrial DNA instead, as it passed down exclusively through the female line, is much more abundant than genomic DNA, and survives far better. This meant that in order to give us something to test against, I had to trace a direct descendant through the female line of Catherine Eddowes. Luckily, a woman named Karen Milner, the 3 times great-granddaughter of Eddowes, had featured in a documentary about the Ripper's victims and agreed to provide a sample of her DNA. It was an amazing breakthrough. We now knew that the shawl was authentic and was at the scene of the crime in September 1888 and had the victim's blood on it. On its own, this made it the single most important artifact in the Ripper case. Nothing else has ever been linked scientifically to the scene of any of the crimes. So now the story of how they tried to get the Jew's DNA. Jari used the same extraction method on the semen traces on the shawl, warning that the likelihood of sperm lasting all that time was very slim. He enlisted the help of Dr. David Miller, a world expert on the subject, and in 2012 they made another incredible breakthrough when they found surviving cells. They were from the epithelium, a type of tissue which coats organs. In this case, it was likely to have come from the urethra during ejaculation. So they are finding tissues from the Jew's penis. Kosminski was 23 when the murders took place and living with his 2 brothers and a sister in Greenfield Street, just 200 yards from where the 3rd victim, Elizabeth Stride, was killed. As a key suspect, his life story has long been known, but I also researched his family. Eventually, we tracked down a young woman whose identity I am protecting, a British descendant of Kosminski's sister, Matilda, who would share his mitochondrial DNA. She provided me with swabs from the inside of her mouth. Amplifying and sequencing the DNA from the cells found on the shawl took months of painstaking, innovative work. By that point, my excitement had reached fever pitch, and when the email finally arrived telling me Jari had found a perfect match, I was overwhelmed. 7 years after I bought the shawl, we had nailed Aaron Kosminski. So on that page, on that link, the links to the Daily Mail articles are also below the video. On this link that I'm reading from here is the article by Dr. Jari as well. He also tells the story and he writes it more scientifically. It's short, but he explains that he found a strand of DNA that showed a 99.2% match. And on testing a second strand of DNA, we achieved a perfect 100% match. Because of the genome amplification technique, I was also able to ascertain, listen to this, the ethnic and geographical background of the DNA I extracted. It was of a type known as haplogroup T1A1, common in people of Russian Jewish ethnicity. I was even able to establish that he had dark hair. Now that it's over, I'm excited and proud of what we've achieved and satisfied that we have established, as far as we possibly can, that Aaron Kosminski is the culprit. And this Dr. Jari is a senior lecturer in molecular biology at a British university. So how freaking awesome is that? The white man's super science is able to solve a crime from over 120 years ago. And they can prove definitively using DNA that it is Aaron Kosminski. And they can even prove through the DNA that it's a man of Russian Jewish ancestry. They can even prove the color of his hair. There you have it. Take note of the image on the screen in front of you, but take special note of the image on the left, that image of the Jew Kosminski on the left, because there are no photos of Kosminski. However, as I'm going to continue reading, you are going to discover the story behind that image. That is the best and most accurate drawing of what he probably looked like. There's Jack the Ripper. There's your Jewish Jack the Ripper. So keep listening, and it relates to that image on the left there. Aaron Kosminski. Whites knew all along, even the cops of the time knew it. The cops even had a witness. The cops themselves knew it. Whites have known that this shithead Jew is the cause, and it's been shown over and over again. And I'm going to give you yet another example that whites have nailed this thing through and through. This is really the ultimate proof, the DNA. But I want to give you one other thing. Also from someone else searching for the truth. This was also on the Daily Mail UK website. This is an article from 2019, and it says, is this the final proof, not that you need it anymore after the DNA, that Jack the Ripper was a Polish barber? A letter found in Australia describes how main suspect attacked someone with a pair of scissors just a year after the killings. So what this is a story about a guy who managed to get a letter. It says, a letter unearthed in a university library on the other side of the world describes how one of the main suspects in the case, Aaron Kosminski, the Jew, had attacked an acquaintance with a pair of scissors less than a year after the killings. So the story is, and it's got the picture of the letters, it says, the document was apparently found in an old book in Australia during a clear out of stock from the University of Melbourne's theology department. It was rescued and sold on eBay, where amateur ripperologist Tim Atkinson spotted it. Father of two, Mr. Atkinson, 53, says the document is a game changer in the Ripper story because it is evidence that Kosminski was violent and aggressive. So now what we've got is a character testimony of this disgusting, filthy Jew. So it says, skeptics of the Kosminski theory claim that although the Polish barber was known to be mentally ill, he was not known to be violent. So let's just stop right there, okay? When they start with skeptics of the Kosminski theory, probably Jews are saying, oh, but he was a barber, and maybe his mind was fucked, but he wasn't really violent, okay? So it turns out that there's an actual letter with some flipping testimony about this Jewish shitbag. So it says, Mr. Atkinson, a self-employed carpet fitter from Bradford, said, the letter shows that Kosminski was not mild and unaggressive, but much the reverse. The possibility of solving the Jack the Ripper case is getting closer. The letter, sent in 1889 from a Reverend William Patrick Dott, D-O-T-T, tells of an attack on a woman named Mary by a Kosminski who ran screaming at her with scissors in the East End. It also mentions Tilly, thought to be a reference to Matilda Kosminski, the suspect's sister. Kosminski, a Polish Jew, was rumored to have worked in a hospital as an orderly before turning up in Whitechapel around 7 years before the Ripper killed at least five women in 3 months in 1888. Kosminski was sectioned several times for suspected schizophrenia, but was not said to have displayed violent tendencies. Mr. Atkinson discovered that the letter's author was a helper at All Hallows Church, Barking by the Tower, at the time. Mr. Atkinson has been to All Hallows and matched the signature on his letter with that of the reverends on an old parish register from 1897. So basically he can prove that this letter that he found in Australia, that the signature on the letter is the signature of this reverend. And it says Atkinson paid £242 for the letter to an eBay seller specializing in antiquities in March. Paper historians have dated the paper and ink to the relevant period. A relative of Mr. Atkinson has also created what he calls the first realistic picture of Kosminski. It was produced by overlaying pictures of the Pole's two brothers and two of his sisters to create a composite image. And it says Kosminski was one of three men suspected of being the Ripper by police at the time, but in the mind of the case's senior officer, Detective Inspector Donald Sutherland Swanson, he was always the prime suspect. He died in a lunatic asylum in 1919. So there you have it. White people who are not quitting, whites constantly hunting for the truth and for reality, and between all of them, with all their efforts, all their ingenuity, our fantastic science, we've got the Jew. We know exactly who the shitbag Jew was, who was busy slicing up those poor white women back in the 1880s. So it's not a figment of our flipping imagination. The European people, using all our methods and techniques to check and double check and make sure that no one's bullshitting and that we've got this thing figured out. We now know about the character of the stupid Jew, that he ran screaming at a white woman with scissors trying to attack her. So he's not just a schizophrenic Jew, he's a violent Jew. I have mentioned in the past my Boer Nazi pal, Fani Kruger, the university lecturer who had a master's degree in psychology. He used to tell me that in the various medical journals and psychology journals that Jews are more likely to be schizophrenic than whites. Jews are more likely to be mentally ill than whites. So just keep that in mind. These are among the things these people try to hide. Their minds are fucked up. And then combined with all their other bullshit, like fleeing justice, whites should never actually be taking in Jews. When somebody wants to smack Jews somewhere, when other whites want to smack Jews and punish them for the crimes that they've committed elsewhere, whites should never be letting these Jews in. You are basically enabling the criminals to run away from justice. So all the German Jew garbage from the time of Hitler, they came to South Africa, they went to Australia, they went to America, vast numbers went to America. So now you've got all these garbage Jews who've managed to survive justice, and their children and grandchildren are big troublemakers and they cause trouble in other countries. We should never actually allow these people in. When other whites are busy trying to sort them out, they should be left there so that those whites can punish them appropriately. So there we know who the flipping Jew is who went and cut these women up and mutilated them in the most horrific way. And that image that you see there is based on drawings, based on people in his family, people related to him. So there you've got it. Jack the Ripper. We know who Jack the Ripper is. Jack the Jewish Ripper. There he is. That's what he looked like. And it's just too flipping bad that somehow the cops didn't have enough evidence to put him away. But they knew this is their man. But I'm always suspicious as to why this story doesn't get put out on the front page of every newspaper out there. Because I think it's probably only the Daily Mail in the UK that's ever published any of these good stories. Obviously, jury everywhere else doesn't want to give this story traction. But it's good that the British have over time persisted and they've gotten to the bottom of this story. It's awesome. A real feather in their cap. Take a look at the image on the screen in front of you, because I spotted something and then a penny dropped. In that earlier news video that you saw about them dealing with the DNA and they want to take it to the government to basically have a government process to finally have an inquest and put this thing to bed for once and for all, that Jack the Ripper is this Jewish barber. In that news story, when they were showing the picture of the shawl, you can go back to it and you can look at it yourself. When they were showing that shawl and they were flipping between various scenes, suddenly they put up this photo as they were talking about this suspect. And they didn't say it there, but I think that what you're looking at, I think it's a certainty that what you're looking at in that photo on the screen on the left is an actual photo of Jack the Ripper. That is Jack the Ripper. And you can go back to that news story because they were talking about the evidence and the only suspect. And as they were doing it, they flashed this photo up. And in the DNA stuff I was reading to you, remember that they had to go down through the Jew Kosminski's female relatives. And remember also that they were talking about the drawing on the right being made using photos of people closely related to him, like his brothers. So at some point, by going down and dealing with the family and getting DNA and all that, they must have not only got photos of his brothers, but also of him. And somewhere along the line, someone got the photo of Jack the Ripper. Because the drawing on the right is made by using close family members, and this photo must be a photo that they obtained somehow. I would guess from family that eventually they found someone who had a photo of him. There you have him, Jack the Jewish Ripper. Jack the Ripper, the piece of shit who was busy doing the most horrific things to white women in a poor part of London. Just absolutely horrific. So there you have it. There's the Jewish bastard. Another thing that also struck me when I was going through those Daily Mail news stories was something I wanted to bring your attention to. And that is that Jack the Ripper was a hospital orderly earlier in his career. So he had worked in a hospital, because when you see him slicing up those women, especially that Lady Eddowes, where he went and he cut out her left kidney and he cut out half of her kidney. This guy may have learned something from his time in the hospital, because it's almost as if he's got a little bit of knowledge of anatomy. Because I was sitting and thinking to myself that him cutting her open and cutting out a kidney and leaving half the kidney in the box. You know, if I had to cut someone open, I wouldn't even know where to find the kidney. So this guy may have some knowledge of anatomy from his time working in a hospital. And that could also shed light on his obsession with these mutilations and slicing open their bodies and doing all kinds of weird things. Another point I want to just bring up again is the fact that they managed to find his semen on that shawl, and that the shawl belonged to him. What nobody says is how and when did the semen get onto the shawl? Did the semen get onto the shawl during the crime or after the crime? Or did it get onto the shawl some other time, like when he was at home? So did he masturbate at home onto the shawl? Or did he do something more bizarre when he had killed Eddowes? Was he trying to engage in necrophilia, sex with a corpse? Or was he masturbating by her dead body? So there's something there as well. In many kinds of crimes, there is a sexual side to the crime. So I think things like necrophilia or even masturbating when he killed her might even be a part of this thing. It might even be a part of this thing. So yeah, that's the story of the Jewish Jack the Ripper, the Jew who tore up those women. And they also say that he killed at least five women. So these are the women that they can connect together, especially on the basis of how they were killed. But it does seem as though the police had other murders that maybe were done in different ways that could have been him, but they weren't him. Because the other thing is, these murders occurred very quickly in a short space of time. But he was around for a long time. So are there other murders that he committed in other ways that were, let's call it, more mundane, and people didn't really notice those murders as standing out? So I think there's a grey area there where the cops also think that there might have been others, but they can't really prove it. There might have been others. Because why would he just engage in murders for a short period of time and then stop? And the fact that he might have written a letter, also the fact that he was a hospital orderly at a point, that adds into the sort of intellectual side, like some of the more modern serial killers of more modern times, where they play with the cops. And this guy's doing it a century before. So there may be quite a bit more to this rotten Jew than we know. There might be quite a bit more to this rotten Jew than we know. And the fact that he attacked a woman with a pair of scissors, screaming at her. Maybe he had a thing against women too. Because some of these serial killers also, like I say, it's sexual and there could be something about women. But yeah, there you are looking at the solution to the fiend who sliced up those poor white women, most of whom were just prostitutes out of poverty. And I did look into that area. There were lots of poor whites who lived there. Really poor whites, men and women. With regard to whites in that part of London being poor, take a look at the image on the screen in front of you. This was also in the Wikipedia page. It mentioned people sleeping in a thing known as a coffin bed. That the people in that part of London were poor and they lived in cramped quarters, and some people lived in hostels. And this photo is from 1900, and it says, "These rows of coffins were the men's sleeping quarters in London's Byrne Street Hostel, circa 1900. So if you look carefully, these are actually beds. They are basically wooden boxes. They look like wooden boxes, and there seem to be metal joints holding them together. And these wooden boxes have got some kind of little mattress and pillow. And what you're looking at are the sleeping quarters in a men's hostel. Just look at that. So white men, poor white men, would probably pay money just to sleep in that little box. Just compare that to modern illegals coming to Britain and other countries and being put up in hotels. I'll bet you that modern blacks wouldn't even sleep in that. Imagine that place being full and men sleeping there. That's really cramped, eh? So those are known as coffin beds. There are many, many things in our history where you will see that white men and women went through all kinds of hardship. Things which today would be unthinkable. But people went on, people faced dangers, people went through hardships, and nobody came to bail white people out. Jews did not form societies to give money to whites who were poor. blacks did not help them from Africa. Whites, at all times in our history, when we've had to struggle our way forward, we have just had to bite the bullet, find a solution to the problem ourselves. And if it's unpleasant, we do what we have to do. We keep our mouths shut. We do what we have to do in order to survive. There's even a quote from Napoleon, where Napoleon did not like people who were lazy. And Napoleon said that people who don't have jobs should be thrown in jail. Yeah? People who don't have jobs should be thrown in jail. And Napoleon said that this is to teach them to get up and go out and do some freaking work. I'm not against that. I'm not saying that Napoleon is wrong for saying that. I just want you to understand the way that whites were, that white people did not have all kinds of excuses. And we didn't run around like the flipping crybabies that Jews are in modern times and blacks are in modern times. All of them a bunch of crybabies begging for help. You go and look at European history, okay? You can look at the history of whites on any continent. You will never find an example where other races come to bail us out or Jews come to bail us out. We've got to do our own thing. And the best that they could hope for example, would be maybe a church or Christian charity. That's as much as anyone could hope for. And I'll bet you even that was very selective and it was limited. For the most part, whites just had to do what they had to do, bite the bullet, suck it up, and get on with life. And you need to understand these poor whites in the east of London in the same way. That is why there was something like, I think, 62 brothels in that part of London. And so you had hundreds of white women who were doing this kind of work. And as you can see, the men are not having it easier either. And if you dig into British history, the British, for example, struggled to find men at various times to go into the Royal Navy. Because being a sailor out at sea, away from normal life for months, and by the way, sometimes years, was not an easy work. It wasn't pleasant. You're away from your wife, you're away from your family, you don't see your family. You can die on the other side of the earth, nobody knows. So the British at various times had press gangs and they would just walk around, and if they see a man who's looking a bit young and strong, they'd flipping grab him and take him off to the Navy. And that was that, man. So when you look at European history, and as I go through various things and I see other examples, I'll show you. But you will see in all European history, we are a practical people. We expect people to get their job done. You cannot run around with a bunch of excuses. You cannot come and complain, oh, I can't do this, I don't have that. There will be options for you. Those options may be unpleasant, and you're either going to have to pull your finger and go and do something unpleasant, but nobody's going to come and help you because you're a crybaby, okay? Our civilization gets stuff done, and we've organized our own nations, and we solve problems without running around like a bunch of crybabies, like these flipping Jews, constant flipping crybabies, crying and moaning and bitching about everything in life. While they are born with a silver spoon in their mouth, or they fall with their asses in the butter, you will see time and time again, all of Western civilization at all times was like this. There are times when things are really hard for everybody, and whites still manage to live, still manage to have children, still manage to hold their lives together. And that is the untold story of countless tens of millions, hundreds of millions of whites who lived in earlier times. We're not a race of crybabies like all the others. And then, when with all our determination and struggle and discipline, then when we finally win, then all the other losers start coming, ah, you conquered this one and you did that thing. But the reality is, you'll see what whites go through as we sort out things and as we live. We're not crybabies and nobody helps us. We bite the bullet and our civilization finds a way. Let's turn our attention to Lewis Carroll. That's the guy on the right on the screen in front of you, a very, very clever Englishman. And those images there are from the 1800s, I think the 1860s, when he wrote Alice in Wonderland. And Lewis Carroll was his pen name. His real name was Charles Lutwidge Dodgson. So basically Charles Dodgson, and Lewis Carroll was his pen name. And he wrote Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. But I think he did a bunch of other things as well. He was a very clever guy, and he was a logician. So Alice in Wonderland was published in 1865. But let me just mention a couple of other things that he did, because this is a clever guy, and he's not someone who did one thing only. He did lots of things. After Alice in Wonderland, in 1871, he wrote a book, Through the Looking Glass and What Alice Found There. 1876, he wrote a book called The Hunting of the Snark. That sounds almost a little bit like that American, the guy we know as Dr. Seuss, the guy who did all those cartoonish-like characters for children. He was also a very clever guy. But anyway, on the screen in front of you is the original Alice in Wonderland, 1865. There's the Cheshire Cat from then. But let's continue. Other books he wrote was Sylvie and Bruno, 1889. Sylvie and Bruno concluded, 1893. But this guy had serious brain power. This guy was a mathematician, but he was a logician as well. So he wrote a mathematical book called Euclid and His Modern Rivals, 1879. He wrote another book called Curiosa Mathematica, a series exploring logic and mathematics. So this guy was probably exploring some of the concepts that would later come in handy in computers. Logic was an important part of what he was up to. He also wrote some poetry. And when it comes to mathematics and logic, Carroll was a lecturer in mathematics at Christ Church, Oxford. He contributed to the fields of geometry, linear algebra, and logic. So he was not only a mathematics lecturer, but he was actually adding to mathematics. The guy is seriously clever. He was also an avid photographer, and he was known for the portraits he took, especially of children, landscapes, and famous people of his time. He was also an inventor. He created puzzles, games, and mechanical devices, including an early version of a word game similar to modern Scrabble. He was a pioneer of symbolic logic. He developed logical diagrams that predated Venn diagrams and wrote books aimed at making logic accessible to a broader audience. It should be obvious that this guy's got a tremendous mathematical brain. This guy would be totally at home in the modern age with things like computers. This guy would have been totally at home with computers and software, totally. He was also a deacon in the Church of England and took an interest in religious discourse, but he never became a priest. So that is the background of Lewis Carroll, a very, very intellectual white man, a man with a lot of energy, his brain is hard at work, and he's contributing to society in so many awesome ways. A man who's done good things for civilization. Lewis Carroll, you cannot fault him in any way. So then, imagine something else. Here you got a guy, extremely talented, gets tons of things done, clever as hell, and guess what? Guess what? They accuse him. There are people who try to tear him down. In more modern times, there's an asshole who actually wrote a book claiming that Lewis Carroll was Jack the Ripper. And I've seen reviews of it. It's total hogwash. It's just complete bullshit. It's just someone malicious trying to tear this fine man down. But there's a little bit more to this. It turns out that Lewis Carroll was onto Jews. Lewis Carroll, super brilliant white guy, was not fooled by Jews. Just like Hitler was not fooled by Jews, just like lots of other whites were not fooled by Jews, this man was not fooled by Jews. He could see them for what they were. So, is it then any surprise to discover that a man who points out a few things about Jews, that the next thing you know is there's all kinds of weird, disgusting, creepy, horrific rumors about him? All of them are false. He's Jack the Ripper. He's a Satanist. He's into drugs. There's all kinds of bullshit stories about this fantastic man, this fantastic white man. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read to you a piece that I published on my website in 2022. It comes from a Jewish website. So I want to read this article to you. Edward Wakeling wrote this book, and it's called Lewis Carroll, The Man and His Circle. What will be of interest to us is some of his anti-Semitism, though, because you'll see some of the things that he wrote about Jews. So the article says, most biographies of Charles Lutwidge Dodgson, the English logician and Anglican deacon who signed Alice in Wonderland with the pen name Lewis Carroll, misunderstood their subject entirely. In his new book, Edward Wakeling persuasively argues that Carroll was not a paedophile. So yeah, yet another one of the disgusting things that they've claimed about him. So anyone who's anti-Semitic, you suddenly find all these bizarre, horrific claims that come out, and you can guess where they come from. So let's continue. Argues that Carroll was not a paedophile, as other writers have hastily concluded, and the odd visions described in Alice did not result from drug abuse, yeah, as previous biographers have charged. Carroll's statements about the Jews, however, remain unexplained. In a 1980 review of an edition of Carroll's Symbolic Logic, the American Jewish logician Irving Kopy suggested as much. A student of Bertrand Russell, Kopy notes that readers of Carroll's logical examples may be put off by the varied remarks about Jews, that they are sarcastic, either hunchbacked or misers, obsequious unless very young, squinting, dishonest, look like goats, have beards a yard long and hooked noses. So it seems that Lewis Carroll had quite a number of things to say as he observed Jews, and clearly Jews did not impress him. To establish a logical premise, Carroll repeatedly offers a phrase such as, quotes, all Jews are greedy. In Symbolic Logic, he proffers the following examples among many. No Gentiles have hooked noses. No Jew is ever a bad hand at a bargain. There are no Jews in the house. No Gentiles have beards a yard long. And a final and yet important one, no Jews are honest. No Jews are honest. So as you can see, you know, maybe in this modern age where we're trying to tell people about Jews, maybe Lewis Carroll was trying to tell people of his time about Jews as well, hey? Maybe he was doing the internet more than 100 years before the internet existed, hey? So that is some of the stuff in his lectures on logic. It continues, jotting in his diary about an 1885 children's rendition of Gilbert and Sullivan's The Pirates of Penzance, Carroll noted, quotes, it was a very charming performance. And some of them have lovely voices, especially Elsie Joel, who acted Mabel. She looks Jewish. Contemporary reviewers also praised the singer, but with no reference to any presumed Semitic origins. So let me pause there. It really looks like Lewis Carroll, in his day, was doing what Hitler and the Nazis were going to do decades later. He's busy looking for Jews. The man is clearly onto Jews. He definitely is onto Jews. I think he looked at Jews, saw them as the garbage that they are, and so he's almost like he's got his Judar. He's got his Jewish radar on. He's looking for Jews. Lewis Carroll. Carroll is quoted in an 1885 interview approving the distribution of free copies of Alice in Wonderland to a London Jewish hospital, stating, "Why in the world, why in the world shouldn't little Israelites read Alice as well as other children?" So, Lewis Carroll is way ahead on the issue of Israel. He is already calling them little Israelites. Let's continue. In chapter 19 of Carroll's novel, Sylvie and Bruno, Dr. Arthur Forrester, a character presented as highly intelligent and moral, offers his opinions about Jews. Forrester points to the Old Testament where rewards and punishments are constantly appealed to as motives for action, that teaching is best for children, and the Israelites seem to have been mentally utter children. How's that, eh? So he says that teaching is best for children, and the Israelites, Jews, seem to have been mentally utter children. So he's basically saying that the Jews in the Bible are stupid. They're basically morons. That's what he says. And he's a deacon. He's a serious Christian. He's a serious Christian with a mathematical mind, and he's looking at what's in the Bible, and he's saying, look at what you see in the Bible. These people are idiots. These people are morons. It continues, Carroll saw Judaism as a religion of killjoys. He differentiated between an Anglican notion of Sunday as a day of rest and the Jewish tradition of keeping Shabbat. Shabbat is their stupid Sunday on a Saturday. He once wrote a letter to an illustrator asking her not to work on projects for him on Sundays, adding, "I do not hold Sunday to be the Jewish Sabbath, but I do hold it to be the Lord's Day and so to be made very distinct from the other days." So he's basically, from a Christian point of view, saying that Sunday for him is the Lord's Day. He's not just copying the Jewish Sabbath. This is a special day for the Lord. So let's continue. Carroll rejected the concept of Shabbat as detailed in chapter 25 of Sylvie and Bruno. Forrester informs Lady Muriel Orme that Sunday is called the Christian Sabbath in recognition of the spirit of the Jewish institution, that one day in seven should be a day of rest. But I held that Christians are freed from the literal observance of the fourth commandment. Such observance, according to Carroll, leads to life-denying piety. Old Testament references translate to no fun in Carroll's eyes. Chapter 10 of Sylvie and Bruno contains an even more noxious stereotype. An indebted customer wards off a tailor demanding payment by offering to double the amount owed each year. Russ Roberts, a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, notes, "Being a tailor was once a stereotypically Jewish profession." So basically, he's got a character in there who's a tailor, and the tailor says, if you don't pay me, I'm going to double the amount you owe each year. So that usury thing is in there. And so this modern academic is saying that maybe Carroll's logic behind this is that he knew that Jews used to be tailors. Although Carroll does not openly state that the tailor is a Jew, the economist John Maynard Keynes, a discerning reader, assumed that this was the case. In Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, a 1930 essay, Keynes argued against deferring gratification. The tailor in Sylvie and Bruno deferred payment in exchange for future greater rewards, denying himself present pleasures for a spurious and delusive immortality. Keynes states, "Perhaps it is not an accident that the race which did the most to bring the promise of immortality into the heart and essence of our religions has done the most for the principle of compound interest and particularly loves this most purposive of human institutions." So basically, Keynes, the economist, quoting from Lewis Carroll, immediately twigs that Carroll is maybe suggesting that the tailor is a Jew. And so Keynes goes on and has a whole love fest about Jews and the wonders of the benefits that they brought to our civilization. Alluding to Jewish usurers with respect to Sylvie and Bruno, Keynes echoed Carroll's unsympathetic view of Judaism as a joyless religion. So at least Keynes wasn't a total Jew lover. He does say that Judaism as a religion is a joyless religion. Yet some joy was expressed by an English Jewish writer, Anthony Goldschmidt, in a 1933 satirical article, Alice in Wonderland Psychoanalyzed, so a Jew taking a stab at Lewis Carroll, which Wakeling charges was playing a role in the subsequent typing of Carroll as a paedophile. So here you go. It is a Jewish writer in 1933 who's actually responsible for the total bullshit, the outright slander of Lewis Carroll as a pedophile. It continues. Goldschmidt was a childhood friend of the playwright Terence Rattigan, with whom he co-authored the 1938 anti-Nazi farce Follow My Leader. Before being killed in action as a Royal Artillery platoon commander in World War II, Goldschmidt, who by then had changed his name to Goldsmith, also encouraged a young soldier to write the famed humorist Spike Milligan. Yet Goldschmidt's wit pales next to Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass Decoded and Alice in Wonderland, The Secret Language of Lewis Carroll Revealed. These books by Dr. Abraham Ettelson, yet another Jew, an American Jewish brain surgeon who served in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade during the Spanish Civil War, claim that Carroll's works conceal messages full of Yiddishkeit. Basically, Yiddishkeit is, let's call it, Jewishness. It's more Jewishness in an Ashkenazi Jew flavor. Let's continue. For example, Jabberwocky is supposedly a code name for the Baal Shem Tov, the ball of wool that Alice's kitten plays with in Alice in Wonderland, symbolizes Tzitzit. The kitten curled up in a corner evokes the four corners of the Tzitzit, Ettelson alleged. So all crap Jewy terms, okay? Carroll's nonsense adjective Frumious, also from Jabberwocky, naturally derives from frum. An added giggle is reading a sober-sided attack on Ettelson's theories in Philosophy of Nonsense, The Institutions of Victorian Nonsense Literature, by a humorless French professor, Jean-Jacques Lecoucle, who decries him as a literary madman. So out of all that crap, it basically seems that a Jewish American brain surgeon wrote books about Lewis Carroll. And the books are Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass Decoded, Alice in Wonderland, The Secret Language of Lewis Carroll Revealed. So he wrote two books. But what he basically went and did, this Jewish sack of crap, was he basically tried to take Lewis Carroll's books and he tried to pretend that there were secret codes in those books. And he even then seems to have tried to twist it as if Lewis Carroll has got Jewish codes in his books. So I'm not sure if he's trying to say Lewis Carroll might be secretly a Jew or something like that. So basically, an American Jewish brain surgeon wrote a bunch of total crap pretending that there is a bunch of codes sitting inside Lewis Carroll's books. Lewis Carroll is a logician and a mathematician. So they're trying to pretend that he's woven some kind of secret bullshit into his books. And it's all hogwash, okay? The goal here is really to just discredit Lewis Carroll, make him look bad, sort of pick him apart, nitpick him apart. He's a great man. He's an awesome man. So this Jewish sack of shit is basically trying to slowly whittle down all the good stuff that everybody believes about Lewis Carroll so that he can say there's something weird and, you know, maybe it's pro-Jewish or maybe it's this or maybe it means that, but he's pretending that there are codes in the guy's books which aren't there, okay? It continues, Wakeling offers no apology for Carroll's statements about Jews, which may well be within the parameters of Victorian British behavior, like the rest of Carroll's idiosyncrasies. Yet Alice in Wonderland is such a remarkable book that one might have wished its author to transcend the common prejudices of his day. So that's the Jewish article. Okay, the book by Wakeling was published in 2014. Basically, what I can say about this article is that it seems to me that Wakeling was actually a pretty good academic or writer, and that he just went and analyzed Lewis Carroll. So the Jews are basically doing their book review of this book. And this author points out that there are people that have been writing a bunch of crap about Lewis Carroll. And so this guy called Goldschmidt, this Jew, this English Jew called Goldschmidt, who then changes his name to Goldsmith because his name has a German sound to it. He's one of the few Jews who actually goes into the war, and he's in the Royal Artillery. And the good news is that a Wehrmacht, that either German artillery or German infantry or somebody managed to get rid of the Jew. But this Jewish writer, Goldschmidt, he writes this, quotes, satirical article in 1933. Let me tell you something. This is the kind of stuff that I look at these days with a jaundiced eye. Here you got a Jew who now goes and writes this, quotes, satirical article, Alice in Wonderland psychoanalyzed. And then he ends up saying that Lewis Carroll is a pedophile, okay? And the Nazis will terminate his existence on this earth. But basically, you got this fucking Jew who, in a quotes satirical article, actually unleashes the entire total bullshit slander that Lewis Carroll is a pedophile, okay? And then you find another fucking Jew out there, this American Jewish brain surgeon, Dr. Ettelson, who writes two books. And he also is busy trying to nibble away at Lewis Carroll to try and mess with his writings and pretend bullshit about his writings, which isn't there. So basically, these Jews, after reading and reviewing this stuff, basically, what these Jews are doing here in this article is they are basically complaining. They're basically complaining that a modern writer is not running around attacking Lewis Carroll for his Jew remarks. Okay. So basically saying, well, this book was written, but You know, this author didn't offer an apology. You know, basically he didn't go on his hands and knees and crawl to the Jews and beg forgiveness to the Jews for what Lewis Carroll did. You know, that, we're so sorry that Lewis Carroll was such a piece of shit. He wrote all these nasty things about Jews. Well, Wakeling obviously isn't a prick, and Wakeling didn't do anything wrong. And Wakeling actually pointed out that it's two Jews that are actually writing a whole load of horseshit about Lewis Carroll. And you can see the way that this article ends, you know, the sort of Jewish snarky disappointment. Oh, Wakeling offers no apology for Carroll's statements about Jews, which may well be within the parameters of Victorian British behavior. So that's interesting. The Victorian British clearly were not impressed with Jews. And then it ends with, "Yet Alice in Wonderland is such a remarkable book that one might have wished its author to transcend the common prejudices of his day." So, you know, all that old Jewish crap, they're always against us, and, you know, they can't treat us the way we deserve to be treated. You know, that is basically the whiny Jewish ending to this article. But at least out of this article, we can walk away with the knowledge that Wakeling, to his credit, has gone in and pointed out that there are other authors, and in this case, both of the ones that he's pointing to are Jews who are lying about Lewis Carroll. So it's good news that a white man stands up for Lewis Carroll and defends his reputation from this disgusting Jewish slander. And so, returning to Goldschmidt, you know, when a Jew comes along, "Oh, this is just a bit of humor, it's just a bit of satire." The Jew is actually malicious. The Jew is malicious. No, it's not a satirical article. It's just a way to pretend he's doing something when in fact his goal is to discredit Lewis Carroll, to make Lewis Carroll look bad, to go out there and slander the man, and he throws in the most horrific lies, in this case, to say that Lewis Carroll is a pedophile. And then when another Jew comes along, he can't go to that extreme, and so what he does is he tries to nibble away at Lewis Carroll in other ways to belittle or befuddle the things that pertain to his wonderful work. Because even as children's stories like Alice in Wonderland, there's a lot of logic in there. There's logic in there, and there's also deliberate nonsense in there. It's a little bit of fun as well, but it's a very cleverly, brilliantly written book. And there's pure logic in that book in places like the trial that takes place at the end and the Queen of Hearts, who is constantly ordering people's heads to be chopped off. And in the end, Alice, who has become more and more confident and has grown in her journeys through Wonderland, Alice eventually turns round and challenges the Queen and, you know, tells her that, you know, this is total junk. This is a rubbish trial. And at that point, Alice wakes up at the end of this dream, and she realizes that it was a dream all along. But it's a dream during which she journeys through Wonderland, sees things, and she actually grows as a result of her experiences in Wonderland. So for the children, it's a fun book, but it's actually a book that adults can look at and they can see the deeper logic in that storybook for children. And let me tell you that lots and lots of fairy tales come out of Europe. There are many fairy tales from Germans. And if you go and you look into the history of children's books and children's fairy tales, you'll be amazed how clever the authors were who wrote these fairy tales centuries ago, where they're telling a children's story, but the story is deep, actually. It's deep and it's intellectual. You know, our race does lots of things where they go over and above the call of duty. You know, they're not just writing like a little story for a child. The story's got depth, it's got meaning, it's got warnings. There's a lot more to these fairy tales than just some cheap rubbish to tell the children. You'll find lots of highly intellectual white men who are responsible for amazing fairy tales. And they go the extra mile. They don't have to go to that length, but they actually do. And in our society, we therefore can have fairy tales where the children can laugh and the children enjoy it and the adults can look deeper and the adults can see, there's a bit more to this than meets the eye. And there's also truth in this, or a meaning that needs to be passed on to the children. It's lovely quality stuff. You know, we have got a high quality civilization and we don't produce a bunch of shit. We are not by nature a bunch of people who run around just doing any old piece of crap for money. Jews, on the other hand, do that. Jews will do anything for money. Jews will also abuse books so that they can write crap to slander people. You know, and a Jew will say, no, I'm just being satirical. Meanwhile, he's much more malicious. His real goal is much deeper, much nastier, etc. From this, we can learn that the Victorian British clearly were not impressed with Jews. The common people were not impressed with Jews. And Lewis Carroll himself is definitely trying to point to Jews in multiple ways. And when I look at it, I think to myself, like with that logic stuff, I think that Lewis Carroll has had a good look at Jews and also Jews in the Bible. And he's not impressed with current Jews. He's not impressed with Jews in the Bible. And he's not impressed with Judaism. I think that Lewis Carroll, from what one can see, is he's exactly like Hitler, exactly like Hitler. He's logical. He's clever. He can see through these people. He's not taken in by all the propaganda. We are God's people. We're God's people. No, he sees right through that. And he looks down on them even. I think his quote there about the little Israelites can read his Alice in Wonderland. To me, the way that he says it, to me, it's almost like he's looking down on these Jews. He sees them for the sacks of shit that they are. I really think that when you look at what Lewis Carroll says about Jews, that this man is in no way intimidated by them. He sees them for the human crap that they are. He sees them for the kinds of people who play the games that they play, for their weirdness that is them. He is not impressed by them at all. And he even looks at the Bible and he says, you know, look at the way they behave. That the, quotes, God's chosen people are actually acting like utter children, basically morons. He doesn't think much of Judaism as a religion, and neither does the economist Keynes. So Lewis Carroll sees Jews for what they are, and he's probably, like I say, by using all those examples, he's probably trying to communicate a bit to people. A Jew is like this, and a Jew is like that, and you won't find a Goyim who's like a Jew, you know? I think he's trying to communicate a little bit to other people there. And so from this, I think we can easily draw the conclusion from this exercise that we have got proof that Jewish scumbags have used various methods to tear down the fine works of a fine man, Lewis Carroll, that they have even told immense lies about him. Therefore, it should be obvious that Jews hate this man who is so famous. They hate this famous, successful white man, white Englishman. They hate him because he has said a bunch of stuff about Jews unapologetically. And so, in the same way that they need to invent lies about Hitler, in the same way, as per my latest video, the one about the lies about the Spanish Christians and the Inquisition, where I also went into all the lies told about the Spanish, that what you got here is you got a bunch of butthurt Jews that hate a man who's famous. A man who's famous has done awesome things. Everybody who looks at his work, all the work that he's done well. He's a clever man. He's a man who's looked up to. Everything he's done is first class. They hate him, okay, because he's said some things about the Jews. And so the Jews are constantly trying to find ways to tear the man down. In the same way that they can't stop lying about the Germans, the Nazis, Hitler, and they can't stop lying about the Spanish Inquisition. Same thing with Lewis Carroll, okay? It's very important for Jews to tear down anyone who has a high standing in society. It's very important for them to tear down anyone in society who's got a high standing. Let me explain why. Because they know that someone who's got a high standing, who is looked up to, that all the rest of the whites will listen to that person and will learn from that person. And so it's very important for Jews, critically important for Jews, to tear down someone like that. They got to keep going after the guy because so many people love him and love his work, and they'll dig into his work and then they'll find, oh my goodness, he wrote this book on logic. Oh, I'd love to read it. Oh, it's got this thing about Jews and that thing about Jews. So they need to kill these things. And so the way that they do it is by trying to discredit this person. And they will have to keep on discrediting this person, inventing lies about this person. So these butthurt, miserable people, various Jews, the Jews will be talking among themselves and, you know, they'll be telling each other, oh, well, you know, Lewis Carroll, he was anti-Semitic. He was such a miserable, rotten guy. He was anti-Semitic. And then they'll see, you know, whether one of them can go and write a book to discredit him and to harm him. And in recent times, there was such a book. I'm not even going to tell you the details about the book, but in recent times, there was someone who wrote a book, and the book is called Jack the Ripper, Lighthearted Friend. And Jack the Ripper, Lighthearted Friend is a modern book that works just like the book of that Jewish brain surgeon. It also goes through the works of Lewis Carroll, and it tries to find things. It tries to find codes, and it tries to make up some stories that actually Lewis Carroll was really Jack the Ripper, and he left codes in his books as proof that he killed those women. Yeah? That's how totally fucked up some of these bastards are. That they go and they look and they write, and the book is published, okay? The book is freaking published, and I'll bet you that there's a little bit of Jewish shit going on there as well, okay? So when you hear Lewis Carroll, pedophile, Lewis Carroll, Satanist, Lewis Carroll, drug abuser, Lewis Carroll, Jack the Ripper, let me tell you, all of it is probably, ultimately, in one way or another, coming from some fucking butthurt Jew. Some butthurt Jews just trying to find yet another way to tear down a fantastic white man. So you should see what they're doing to Lewis Carroll, as the same thing they do to Hitler, same thing they do to the Nazis, same thing they do to the Germans, same thing that they do to the Spanish Inquisition and that kind of thing. Just a bunch of butthurt Jews, and they will carry on like this for centuries. Some other stupid bastard will probably come along in the future and try and invent yet another story against Lewis Carroll, because Lewis Carroll was a highly acclaimed lecturer, a man who contributed to mathematics. That's a tremendous thing. I must tell you, to be able to contribute to mathematics is like contributing to science. You know, you got to have a real flipping high IQ in order to do it. And this man is a fantastic man. So just be aware when you hear any kind of shit about Lewis Carroll, it's probably just yet another piece of crap invented by some butthurt Jew, some Jew looking for a way to stab Lewis Carroll in the back, like they do with Hitler. Oh, Hitler wanted to have sex with his mother, you know, all that kind of stuff, all the same old fucking crap. Hitler was a sexual weirdo, all that bullshit. Who's the real sexual fucking weirdo, okay? The real sexual weirdo is Jack the Ripper, a Polish Jew, freaking deviant maniac, killed women, semen, maybe at the crime scene, you know, masturbating, or, you know, maybe even trying to have sex with a corpse or something. Who's the real freaking deviant, okay? The real freaking deviant is Jack the Ripper. But these butthurt, malicious Jews cannot handle when one of their own demented pieces of garbage is exposed, yet they will quickly go and attack a very fine white man who's high quality, and they'll even try to get the crimes of a Jew and blame the crimes of a demented, sexually perverted, mentally ill Jew onto a very fine white man. And that's a thing that I've seen as I've gone through things in history. Nowadays, I keep an eye open for, is there someone who's consistently being slandered? Is there someone who's either consistently being slandered, or all kinds of weird rumors are constantly coming up regarding that person? If you see something like that, feel free to contact me and tell me where you see it, because I'm telling you that I think you will find in history that there are lots of good white men and women who may have been slandered by these Jewish scum in centuries past, and being the hateful, unforgiving rubbish that they are, once they hate you, they will lie about you until the end of time. So there could well be other people, other good white people, that have had, let's call it, the Jewish treatment. And we might look at them in a weird way, and we don't know that maybe that was a good white person who was also onto the Jews, and these Jews are busy trying to tear that person down. The same way, like with the Spanish Inquisition, the king of the time, and the death of his son, as I mentioned in that video, where they then invent the propaganda, oh, the king killed his son. The king killed his son because the grand inquisitor, the prime mover, who wanted to have the Jews kicked out of Spain, the prime mover, the first inquisitor, is then used as the bad guy. Ah, the inquisitor is telling the king, kill your son, you know? And they try to make up that whole flipping story about that. Meanwhile, it's all bullshit. It's all bullshit and hogwash. It's just to smear the king of Spain, smear the Spanish, smear the Catholics. That's all it is. It's nothing more than that. And I think that Jews are doing this thing in lots and lots of places, and we maybe just need to keep an eye open for good, honest, talented whites, and maybe a way of detecting who was a good white who was onto Jews is just look to see characters in history who are tremendously slandered, and then we maybe take a closer look. You might find that, yeah, there's yet another person taken down, and Jews have been lying for hundreds of years about him, and that's the real story. Maybe he was actually a really cool dude who was onto them, just like Lewis Carroll. Lewis Carroll, very high IQ, very awesome man, onto these Jews, and as you can see, high IQ, high intellect. Let me end by giving you another tiny story from Lewis Carroll to show you that you're dealing with a man of very high IQ, a man who's deep, a man who's deep, who's not stupid, he's deep, he knows lots and lots of things about life, a man with a tremendous brain, a really awesome guy. In 2022 on my website, I published a little story, and I remind people that Lewis Carroll hated Jews. Author of Alice in Wonderland, What Did Humpty Dumpty Say? Someone sent me a quote, and this quote is from the book Through the Looking Glass, Chapter 6. So it's about Humpty Dumpty, and it's a short quote, and I want to read it. So the quote is, this is Humpty Dumpty speaking. "When I use a word," Humpty Dumpty said, in a rather scornful tone, "it means just what I choose it to mean, nothing more nor less." "The question is," said Alice, "whether you can make words mean so many different things." "The question is," said Humpty Dumpty, "which is to be master, that's all." And so it's a quote from Through the Looking Glass, Chapter 6. And so there you get an example of something written in a child's book by Lewis Carroll. And although this is a child's book, this is a serious book, okay? And inside this thing, inside the fun, there is very serious logic, actually. So here you've got Humpty Dumpty, who says, "When I use a word, it means what I want it to mean. It means what I want it to mean, nothing more and nothing less." So in other words, Humpty Dumpty can take words, almost like a Jew, and Humpty Dumpty can take a word and give it different meanings as it suits him, when it suits him, and it has only that meaning when he chooses it to have that meaning. But if he wants it to have a different meaning, then it has that meaning at that point in time. So what is taking place here is actually a logical discussion and a sophisticated discussion, actually. And Alice says to him, whether you can make words mean so many different things, you know. Can you take one word and give it, you know, 10 different meanings, and the meanings change as and when it suits you? And Humpty Dumpty gives her a very strange answer. Humpty Dumpty says, "The question is, which is to be master, that's all." And when I look at that, to me, Humpty Dumpty is actually countering her and saying, "I'm the boss, I'm the master. The things are what I want them to be, no more and no less. I'm the master, and that's all that matters. I'm the boss, I do as I please." In that sense, you almost have Lewis Carroll talking like Nietzsche, yeah? Friedrich Nietzsche, talking about power. So I can't find any evidence that Lewis Carroll did study Nietzsche, but it gives you an idea of the kind of depth of thinking of Lewis Carroll, that he's thinking in terms literally as sophisticated as Nietzsche. It's well within his capabilities. So there you have it. Reality yet again shows that Jews are overrepresented among the bizarre, the creepy, the horrific, the disgusting, the mentally ill, as has now been proven definitively using forensic methods, proper Western methods. And you can see yet again, these Jews are always trying to defend their rubbish and trying to hide their crimes and their garbage. But Jews will take a lot of energy to go and tear down good white people, good, fantastic white people who are excellent at what they do. So Lewis Carroll, he is in the same arena as Hitler, as Goebbels, Nazis, Germans, Spanish, Inquisitors. He's right in there. Yet another white man, is awesome, does awesome things. And the Jewish scum hate him like hell. And don't ever underestimate the ability of these people to hate people. They can hate all kinds of people. It is not whites who hate. Whites are actually logical. It is rare for whites to get really, really emotional. But Jews are the real haters. They are the ones that for the slightest thing, they can hate and hate. Here they are hating and hating a man who never attacked them, never killed them. But they will run around and defend their serial killers and murderers, whether it's the Jew who killed Mary Fagan or whether it's Jack the Ripper. They'll cover it up. These are a totally alien people. Totally alien, very bizarre, very weird. And they bring with them all their crap in the same way that the Polish Jew brought Jack the Ripper to London. And don't imagine that these racial things will go away. They'll always be there. And people need to start being aware of race. Thank you very much for listening today. I hope that you learned something new today. Look after yourselves and take care. We'll be chatting again soon. You reach the top, at the top, that is where you'll stay.
give up, my friend. If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you'll win. Every fight you fight, every game.